Hello, and welcome to ngbuild-pod, where we share with you our knowledge of Angular, all the mistakes we've made, and some of the things we've gotten right. I'm Chris Kamak, and with me as always is the ardent John Graham. We are both full-stack Angular developers that love to share and be part of the developer community. We both work here at Miles Technologies in Lumberton, New Jersey on the Engine team, and we've spent the last several years building out the Angular template for the Miles software division. So John, what have you been up to in the past couple days?
Yeah, so recently I've been trying to get a good schedule going again. In the past, I think at the beginning of this quarantine, things were a little rough and things were all chaotic, but I've been doing good. I got this new book, which I'll talk about in a little bit. So I do I finish work, do the bedtime with the kids, read the book until a certain time, start to wind down for bed. It's been really good. Maybe interchange a video game every once in a while to get some entertainment. But my focus recently has been on getting a schedule going so that I feel like I have some control over what's going on right now in my life.
Sure, that could be really important.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm really enjoying it, so it's been going well.
Excellent.
How about you?
Lately, the thing that most recently changed for me was I went from basically being upset that I couldn't see people to realizing I can see people if I use things like Zoom. As a person involved in technology, you'd think that that would be just my first place I'd go. But instead, I kind of just went into a corner and became Gollum and stopped interacting with the world.
Well, when you use it at work all the time, it's probably like, you don't think of it in your personal life.
Yeah.
Other people that have never used it for work are like, oh, this thing's amazing. But we've been using it for years. So we're like, Zoom, not again.
Yeah, it does a little bit feel like work. I mean, that's partially probably why I've been avoiding it. But lately what I've been doing, if you haven't ever tried this, I recommend it. Lately what I've been doing is I've been using Zoom. Me and Aaron and myself, we would get with two other people. In this case, it was our kids that we couldn't see at this time. We did charades with them. So what we would do is we would pass ideas of what the person's acting out, and there'd be a different person on either side of the Zoom call that was the partner. Mm. So you have to, through Zoom, using the video only in Zoom, act out something that the other person can guess, which of course is next to impossible. But, it lends itself to some interesting things, I think it was a lot of fun.
Good memories, that's for sure. It's kind of funny, you made me think about, because I think, South Carolina or somewhere down there opened up, bars recently, and mm-hmm. I was watching some video of a guy that he, took while he was at the bar, and he said, the coolest thing about the bar being open is he could sit outside and look at other people existing. He said it was just weird for him to just see other people going about a day, and just talking and sitting around each other. It was just strange. I thought that was just such a weird take on it. I'm like, man, what's it gonna be like when we go back out?
Yeah, I don't know. I have no idea about it, but yeah, I think that's a pretty interesting thing that's happened with all the changes. And you and I are gonna have the opportunity to go back to work soon. And when we do, which I'm not saying I'm going to right away, but when we do, I'm going to really enjoy just having that water cooler talk or round the coffee maker talk of what have you guys been up to and what kind of projects are you working on? Because you don't get that when you're only working with your team and you're kind of sequestered away.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't wait to give you a hug, Chris.
Oh, you should not do that. I am totally nuclear at this point. You should not touch me.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think people have gotten their coronavirus pandemic fill. Let's. What are we going to talk about today that's not related to that?
Yeah. Well, today our official topic is about clean components and services. So, if you think about the building blocks of an Angular app, it really comes down to components and services predominantly. And when you're architecting your app or even just refactoring it, each component and service should be clean, it should be purposeful. And we want to remove as much cruft as we can and present these clean, straightforward components and services. And of course, most apps are complex. you know, they have messy business logic and conditions that can make this really challenging. So today we're going to talk about some tips on how you can limit your component's scope and how you can use the power of services to your advantage during the process. But this is like a, this is a really large topic that can go in a lot of directions, and it can get unwieldy, but we're going to try and keep this boxed. We're going to try and really make it something that hopefully everyone listening can get something useful out of it. And John, I think you had a great starting point for us, right?
Yeah, well, I think maybe we just jump in on our quick tips, and then we'll throw into that. Does that sound good?
That's absolutely correct. I cannot forget the quick tips.
I forgot it once already, and then you did it once now too, so we're even on this. But that's excited about my quick tips, so that's why I remembered it this time.
You go ahead. You go first.
Yeah. So my quick tip is a new book I've been reading that I've been really enjoying. I actually got turned on from John Carmack, who is the id guy that wrote Doom. He's a really fun guy to follow on Twitter. It's called Ultra Learning. And it's by, Scott Young. And he really just kind of covers, I think anybody in like an engineering role or even like really a development role, this is like a great book because I'm about halfway through it. And he covers, how to compress your learning, down into very small windows, but gain a lot of things out of it. So like, he spends a lot of time thinking about how he's going to learn something before he starts learning it so that he doesn't waste time while he's learning it. His famous thing is he completed the MIT computer science degree in 1 year.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah. So he compressed it all down and he kind of talks through a lot of his thought process, and I'm really enjoying it. It's very, like, the idea is to be very intense. You know, I've got kids, I've got, work and things, so I can't do I wouldn't be able to do the 1 year MIT course, but certainly grabbing some snippets from it to help with my learning for things that I'm looking into for, you know, development or work or whatever. It's been really eye-opening, some ideas. I like it a lot. I would definitely recommend it. It's a really easy read, I think.
So you're getting a lot out of it, you'd say.
Oh yeah, for sure.
So just a quick question personally, I'd like to know. It sounds to me like in order to accomplish the kind of things that he's laid out, I mean, you'd have to, step one, cut off all relationships because you can't have any time that isn't directly, you know, useful towards this purpose. Like, is this the kind of thing that we're talking about here, or is it more like just using the time you have to the best ability?
Yeah, it's certainly how he did his thing, which was like 40, 50 hours a week, you know, to do the MIT course. But he talks about like scaling things, right? So, one of his things is to, do research about the topic you're going to learn. And what he means by research is like, how are other people learning it? What resources do you have to learn? What are the tests that people are giving for it? Like all of these things you do ahead of time to focus your learning. So what he says is if you're going to spend 50 hours on it, take 10% of that time to do R&D. So if that's going to take you 8 weeks to spend 50 hours because you can't compress it all down like you were saying, then it may take you 2 weeks to do the R&D. Right. So he comes up with these scales that you can follow where, like me, I can probably spend 5 hours a week on learning realistically. So I just need to scale it appropriately. So I may be doing a step longer than what somebody else might be if I'm not going to spend as much, if I'm going to spread out my time more.
I got you.
But okay. A lot of it's about being able to focus and jump in and out of focus and all this stuff. He comes up with really good examples for things. So, I think it's both, which is nice.
All right. Yeah. Good bring up.
Yeah. How about you? What do you got for your tip?
So it's the it's all about scheduling for me, especially in the coronavirus world that we're in now. Keeping a schedule and keeping motivated is a really hard thing to do. A while ago, like a couple years ago, you had introduced me to this concept of the Pomodoro technique, which just in very, very short form is a way of structuring your time for productivity where you put it into increments or blocks and you have scheduled breaks. And doing this allows you to keep a structure. It also maximizes your effectiveness so that you don't go so hard or so fast in a direction that you end up kind of going, blowing past the solution, or maybe just hitting the same wall over and over again. And so I found this to be incredibly useful. So I just wanted to point it out to everybody. It's very, very simple. You can look up more information about it, of course, and I'll include a link, but let me just give you the real simple version of this. 25 minutes, you set a timer. If you have a Google Home Assistant, which you know I do, or an Alexa or whatever, you just say, hey, set a timer for 25 minutes. When that timer goes off, you stop working. Doesn't matter where you are in the process, you just stop. And then you set another timer for 5 minutes. That's your break time. You go stand up, go someplace else. Do not stay at your computer. Literally stand up, go someplace else. Get a snack. Go do whatever it is that you do that isn't working. And then you come back and you set another timer for 25 minutes. And now you can go press hard on that solution again. And the idea here is that when you get to a certain rotation of these, whether it be 3 times that you've done this cycle or 4 times, it's kind of up to you. At that point, you would take a longer break, possibly 15, 30 minutes to really refresh and then go right back at it again. And by doing it this way, you're forcing yourself to have breaks, which if you think about it, when you're in an office setting and you're working with a team, you kind of have breaks anyhow because people come by and they say hello or they tell you about their weekend or you remember you needed to talk to somebody. So you stand up and you go talk to them. But when you're at home, none of that's there. There's no interruptions. So you just go press hard forever in a direction and then you kind of come out bleary-eyed and wonder why you don't have a solution yet. So that's my tip.
Yeah, I love that. It's always good. I don't use it every day, but I do certainly use it when I feel like I need a productivity adjustment. You know what I mean?
Yeah, especially when your mood starts to become a factor. That's my trigger. When I realize that I'm becoming frustrated, I'm like, okay, I got to pull that Pomodoro out because I'm obviously doing something wrong here.
Yeah, for sure. All right, cool. Awesome. So let's maybe go into how we're going to introduce this topic, because like you said, this is like a super big topic, right? We're talking about having, you know, well-structured, clean components, when to refactor them, you know, how to make things as simple as possible. And all that stuff can be kind of difficult to wrangle. So I think for a good starting point here is we're going to jump into the concept that, you know, is fairly, I think, well known in the software development world, and that's code smells. And so what do we mean by code smells in this context? So I think most people that work as a developer don't build brand new applications every single day. They may build them sometimes. They may never build them. You know, it depends on, you know, where you're at. And code smells are just a way of, I think, really starting to identify, you know, when things aren't going well, when you may need to refactor. Because one of the hardest things about this concept is, where is it? Like, how do I know something isn't clean or needs to be refactored or restructured? And, you know, the analogy I use is like, you know, I'm not talking about good smells here. You know what I mean? Like, you're not looking at a piece of code and saying, wow, that thing is great. You know, you want the rotty, dirty banana sitting in the corner of the room code. That's what you want to see. And, you know, when you're trying to figure out where to get started and what to do, this is a great way to just like start to get some of the low hanging fruit out of the way. And try and start to look into your code a little bit from a different perspective. So that you can start to get started on this.
Yeah, I agree. And I think I'd rather not see the rotten banana. Like, it's not what I'm wanting to see. But more often than not, there is a rotting banana in some corner that is really making this code look not so good. So when we say smells, you're basically saying that we're looking at the code objectively. And we're saying, you know, something here doesn't look right. It just on first pass, this doesn't seem to fit well. Is that kind of a good way to sum that up?
Yeah, it's like a cursory look at things, right? You're not diving deep into, you know, this isn't about like a you know, is the right design pattern used here, right? Like, we're not talking about that. That's like crazy details. In fact, I think we'll avoid design patterns at all costs in this, because I think they're tough to, you know, think about when you're refactoring. But yeah, it's the things that are obvious, you know. So like, what's a specific example of like what is a code smell? So if I open up a component and I have to hit the page down button and I don't have to just hit it. I have to hold it down to get to the line of code that I want to see. That's a smell to me, right? That's a huge component. Maybe it's fine. You know, we're not saying it's wrong. You know, that's what the code smell is, not identifying incorrect behavior. It's identifying, you know, things that don't quite look right, right? So like a huge component is one thing. If like I read a function and then I have to read it again, and then maybe I have to read it a third time, you know, that's something that's like, maybe this is me not understanding it. Maybe it's maybe written in a little bit of a strange way. Those are some like kind of quick examples of things that, you know, I see. But I think there's some more maybe Angular examples we could talk about.
Sure. And I think that the thing you're bringing up about the functions is a really important one. I mean, first off, we have to define what we mean by that, that functions really should be single purpose. They should have something specific that they're doing. They should not have a ton of things that they're doing, unless that's an orchestration function where it's calling a bunch of smaller functions inside of it. But the idea is it shouldn't be doing so many tasks that by the time I get down to the 30th line of the function, I forget what the first five lines were even doing because they are not related anymore to the thing I'm reading on line 30. You know, and I think that's, it's important to talk about that. You know, these things should be single purpose.
Yeah, and I think these are like general code smells that I think you could find in any software that's written in any language for anything, really. You know what I mean? There's always an equatable factor there. You know, I think one of the things that is really useful with Angular is to kind of think about, you know, how the structure of Angular code should be set up, right? So one of the things that I use as a great code smell when I'm going through like code reviews and stuff is I look at, is this logic that's written in component in the component not actually interacting with the template at all, right? Like, does it actually change a property or control something that's going to be affected in the view? If the answer is no, that's a code smell, right? Should it be there? Yeah. Should it be in a library? Should it be in a service? You know, we got to keep these components tiny. So let's look into refactoring that.
Sure. And I think that tiny is like, I would like to throw in a different word on that, purposeful. You know, that means tiny. That means you're going to be smaller because you have only one purpose and you're doing that purpose really well. But by saying purposeful, we're talking about, it's not just about size. It's about scope. You know, it's about making sure that it does a specific thing and it's not charging in different directions.
Yeah, and I think like, you know, what's the, one of the things that we haven't really touched on yet is like, what's the even the point of looking at these code smells, right? So we've given some things, but you could argue, hey, you know, I like big components, or I think it's fine, or these sorts of things. You know, so I think it's important to maybe talk about why we think some of these code smells become a problem later on, right? Because if you're new, or you're just starting out with a code base, or you haven't worked on a larger Angular applications, it's hard to maybe see, well, does it really matter if I take this thing and put it in a library? What's going to be the downside of that? And, you know, I think one of the great things about code smells for me is not necessarily identifying what's wrong with that specific thing you're looking at, right? So if we're looking at a function, like you were saying, that's maybe not purposeful, you know, that's a particular problem that you can look at and figure out how it's going to impact your code. But the thing that I like about the code smell concept is it's a checkpoint, right? So think about your development process. At what point in your development process do you say, let me look at things that need to be refactored, right? I think in some cases you may do that as you're writing code. If like you're updating a section and you see something you don't like, that's a point where you'll say maybe it needs to be refactored. But to me, there's not really a great mechanism to look at it proactively, or just, you know, without you know, being in a section that you're writing in. So I like the code smell concept because it at least makes you look at things differently, right? Like it doesn't, it takes you out of the box of software development of this particular application and say, hey, what could be going wrong here?
Yeah. And it's, I think in a lot of cases, if you were to say, why do we care? Like, why is it important to look at this stuff? It comes down to future proofing in a lot of cases, right? Like, it's not about, does this work today? It's more about, if I build on this tomorrow, then what? You know, like, is this going to get uglier and bigger and nastier over time if I don't right now start to separate things out and make them cleaner? Because I think there's this concept in software development where one of the things that you'll end up doing is building on top of something that exists already. And you'll take whatever practices were there, and because of consistency's sake, you'll be like, okay, well, I need to do those the same way. Well, what if the old way wasn't very good? Or what if the old way was one of these smells? Now, am I repeating it? Am I making it smell worse? Am I amplifying the smell?
Yeah, my favorite thing when I ask somebody a question in a code review is they say, well, this is how it was done over here. you know what I mean? Which is fine. I mean, I copy and paste pretty frequently as well. But like you're saying, like, this concept is about getting ahead of that so that, you know, you don't end up copying and pasting a bunch of, you know, poorly executed logic because you did that poorly on purpose for a reason into other pieces. And the thing that I like to think about is, like, you get into a really heavy semantical argument about, like, whether something's worth refactoring or not. And I think at the end of the day, like, we're talking about purposeful small components, whatever the case is. And I think a lot of people go too far and they want components to be completely single use and all this stuff. I'm not saying to do that, but there's a reason why we don't write all of our Angular logic in one component.
We don't just have an app component, you're saying?
maybe some people do. and maybe there's a good reason for it. But, like, you know, I think most people don't, right? So, like, take that thought, right, which I think a lot of times it's done where that's kind of what you're being told to do, right? That's what the direction is, which is fine. But, like, so let's take that and think about it a little bit, right? I'm not saying to, you know, create a million components for a to-do app. I'm just saying that think about it a little bit, right? And when you identify these things, you know, look into them a little bit more.
Yeah. I will say this. I know that this may not be a popular opinion, but I'm going to throw it out there because it's my opinion. I do think it's worthwhile to have a lint rule in your application that indicates a max length on a file. You know, because when I say max length, I'm talking about max line length, which, you know, if you want to be careful about it, maybe you should also make a max length on the line and a max number of lines so that you can't cheat it in one direction or the other. But the idea I'm saying is, I think that it is purpose. There is a purpose to having that kind of a rule in play. You want to know when a component is incredibly large and you want to call it out and say, hey, this is really big. Maybe we ought to do something about it. And maybe the answer is no, we're not going to do something about it. And if that's the case, you can ignore that rule on this file or whatever. But by having that rule, it forces you to face it and say, yep, this is really big.
Yeah, and I think, you know, people will argue that slows things down, which I agree with. You know, it depends on your circumstance. Like, you know, if you're hacking away at something as a proof of concept, I'm not worried about the line length. You know what I mean? I just want to get something out, see if it's a valuable idea, and then get moving. If I'm building a template that, you know, at some point hundreds of other developers will look at and use as a guide or reference, maybe I want to slow down a little bit and do it right. You know what I mean? So that's kind of the balance that you need to strike between the two.
Sure.
So yeah, so that was code smells. I think that's like a good concept to think about when we're doing this. And that's more, I think, broad, applies to most development platforms. Let's maybe get into some of the stuff that's like very specific to Angular. What are some things that you see in components that you think fall under this category of could be refactored or aren't clean or something like that? Do you have any specific examples?
Yeah, I mean, I have a few things that I think we could talk about, but I'm going to start off with something that I think is really straightforward, which is the properties. So if you're formatting your component in the way that I've seen a lot of people do it, which is you declare your component in your component file, you say export class component, and then right after that, you've got all your properties, like your input properties, your output properties, and any private properties or whatever it is that you have going on. And then there's the constructor, And then below the constructor is all the functions. And that's just a common way that I've seen things put together. If you look at that list of properties, and it's really long, that's probably a good sign that something could be amiss. I mean, for example, let's say that you have a bunch of properties on there for like first name, last name, birth date, you know, and those are all properties that might be part of a person, right? Why are we listing each property separately in that case? Is kind of the thought process. Do I need three lines, one for each of these things, when I could have just had one line that said person? And that person, I can access dot first name, dot last name, dot birth date. So storing it as an object instead of literal values. And why not do it that way? Because it shortens up the length and it makes it easier to access.
Yeah, and I think this is a thing that it depends on where you come from. I think most people probably don't start with Angular as their very first development platform. So where did you come from, right? So you and I, we come from a .NET background, right? C#, VB, object-oriented. So I think it's been much easier for us to, embrace the object-oriented aspect of Angular and TypeScript and to utilize it. But I think you and I see some people that, maybe got hired after we made the switch and come from a more JavaScript background, Python background, things like that, more dynamic languages. And they're totally cool with, just slap a bunch of properties on it. We'll worry about the object later, that kind of thing. And, and it's not wrong, right? It accomplishes the goal. But, you come in and you look at a component and, you start with employee, but then you need to add address and then you need to add contacts and then you need to add all these other things. And now you've got 40 properties. So, you're scrolling before you even get past the properties to get to logic. And it's just so hard to track. Like, it's really hard to follow what the heck is going on in this component. There's just too many different things. Versus if I have objects, I can collapse them. I don't need to look at all this stuff on one screen.
Yeah, I think that a good point to bring up here is it doesn't mean that you should take your properties and refactor them into an object. Maybe you should, maybe you shouldn't. But it is at least an indication that perhaps this component is doing too much. If I've got 40 properties on this component, it's either I've got way too many properties and I don't need them all, or I'm handling too many different kinds of things. Like you had mentioned in your example, you brought up employees, contacts, addresses, customers, vendors, whatever it is that we're talking about. If I'm accessing all of those different kinds of objects in this one component, is it doing too much? Maybe it is. I'm not saying it definitely is. I mean, who knows? The scope could be whatever.
Yeah, and that's a great bring up. You definitely don't want to have that component probably set up that way in the first place, whether or not you want to use properties or objects. And I think like one of the other things that's really important to talk about, because it's part of the component, is the template. And, I know one of the things that you and I are big fans of is, controlling where logic occurs. I think you can play hard and fast and loose with templates where you can... because you have the interpolated, expressions is what I meant to say. Because you have the expressions, you can do a lot, right? Like you can basically write JavaScript in your template. But I think in our opinion, like when we look at templates and we see, a bunch of ternaries, a bunch of NGIFs, a bunch of random things happening, we don't really want to have that split, right, between the component and the template, right? If you're going to write some, logic to do conditionals, maybe just put it in the component and have the template just call into a value or something like that. I think it helps keep the template clean. You don't have a bunch of, NGIFs where you're bringing things in and out of existence. And you know where to go when you're checking this, like, conditional logic, right? It's all going to be in the template. Or in the component, I meant to say.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I mean, keeping logic out of the templates in general, I think, is usually a good idea. But what you really want to avoid is you want to avoid reading a template file. And again, always think of this as if as if it's somebody else who wrote this. I mean, you may be the person who wrote it, but guess what? If you wrote it 6 months ago, it was somebody else, because you don't remember what you thought 6 months ago, most likely. A lot of times you're looking at this stuff with a fresh set of eyes, and you're kind of like, even if you did write it, you're looking at it and saying, oh, I can't believe I did things that way, you know, because that was 6 months ago. It was like a lifetime. But when you're looking at this stuff, you don't want to be reading the template and then trying to understand, scratching your head, well, wait a minute, when does this show? Because the complicated logic in there is hard to understand, that you're looking at this ternary, possibly in a ternary. And I've definitely seen that in templates before, where you've got one ternary and it's like, well, if that's true, then let's check another ternary.
Ternary section.
Yeah, that gets really hard to understand. Like, and then I'm like, wait, when does this show? And as soon as I start questioning things like that, looking at the template, I think I've already lost the battle.
Yeah, great analogy that, like, you kind of brought up, and I'll take it one step further. Is like, think about like when you write an essay in school, right? So like, if the essay is the template, when you're incorporating things into the template, you don't just copy and paste the whole source, right? You don't just take, like, if I'm reading from Wikipedia, I'm not going to throw it all in there. So now midway through this essay, I'm reading this Wikipedia article because it's got all this logic in there to try to figure out what's going on. You know, you want to take it and summarize it and stick it in there in a point, right? Which is what a function can be used for, or a pipe can be used for, something like that. It encapsulates a bunch of logic into a straightforward point, so that as a reader, when I'm going through, I'm not having to branch out into this crazy thing that really may not even have anything to do with what I'm trying to figure out. But I think you do have to be a little careful. There are some performance things to consider when you do functions in templates, which we did cover a very long episode ago, I think like episode 1 or 2, about using pipes and things like that in some different ways with Angular. But yeah, I like a lot of those ideas of the templates. Keep them templates, you know, don't worry about putting too much stuff in there.
Yeah, where it's reasonable to do so, for sure. Next thing we wanted to talk about was going into the concept of services and how do services relate to this. Because if you're saying that components should have a clean, purposeful design, then if we have these services, how do they figure into that? Like, I think a lot of people tend to think of services as something that you're going to go and get CRUD. You know, you're gonna hit your API, and you're gonna get all of the customers, or you're going to edit a customer, or you're going to push a new customer. You know, and that's like where services end for some people in the Angular world, and I can't blame them, because that is certainly what most examples show, but services really can be a lot more than that, and they probably should be. In a lot of cases, the services can act as your business logic layer. And I don't know if that's a term that I learned when I started working for Miles, or if that's more of like an industry term. Maybe you can help me figure that out.
Yeah, I think that it's like anytime you're talking about like N-tiered architecture, right, or layering your applications, you're going to have the concept of a business layer. I don't think it tends to come up in like front-end frameworks frequently, because that's usually where you're doing logic and code that you don't want the user to have any control over what happens. Mm-hmm. But I like the concept here that you're getting at, because like I've seen you take some scenarios and services and things that you know, the components are doing a lot of the heavy lifting on the work, and you're able to, you know, refactor them and move them back. And like one of the ones I really like is the example of like the login for our authentication, right? And if you think about what needs to happen with the login process, right? So I could have a login screen that calls a login service, authenticates the user, and then just returns the, you know, whether or not it was authenticated, right? And that's fine. But now in the login, what do I do with that? So now I have a token, I have an authentication point. What happens next, right? And I think you've done some pretty cool things with the services to combat that problem.
Yeah. And I think that I'm going to throw in an idea that it works really well for me, and hopefully other people's will find useful as well. And that is using the concept of pseudocode in this kind of example. So like if you think of pseudocode, what it really comes down to is instead of actually writing the logic to do something, you write a comment that simply says what you're planning on doing. So for instance, you would make a comment that says, we're going to call the login service here, you know, and then underneath that line, maybe you'd make another comment that says, if the login's successful, we're going to do this. And if it's not successful, we're going to do that. And you're kind of starting to map out your plan. And that's what pseudocode really comes down to. Now let's take that and translate that. If I'm looking at my pseudocode in that example, and I say the first thing is I'm going to call the login service and try to log in. And then I say if it's true, if that actually is a successful login, I'm going to do one thing. If it's false, I'm going to do another thing. The question is the component the one that should be responsible for doing the thing on true and for doing the thing on false, for success and failure, or not? Is the component really just showing a box where you type your username and your password and then you hit the submit button? If that's all it does and all it cares about, then whatever steps are next, and in the case of login, let's talk about those just real briefly, you would try to save the token, probably in a cookie, so that you can use it later. That's one step. Another step is you'd probably want to update some sort of in-memory variable that says who is the current user so that later on I could grab their name or their user ID if I need to know that information. So those are two steps that have to happen. And is the component responsible for those things? Not really. If you think of the component as being simply a UX piece, why does it need to be the one responsible?
Yeah, and if you think back to like code smells, that's kind of identifying these experiences, like these samples of things after the fact. I think with like the pseudocode, the thing that I like about it, that from what you described, is it helps you kind of start to think about these concepts before they become a problem. Right. So like if I'm just going in and you tell me to write a login and I just boom, I ng generate new component login, or as you would do, copy, paste old component, delete everything, change the name.
I'm not shaming. Be nice to me.
Just, we got to work on your Angular CLI skills someday. But, you know, and I just start plugging away. Right. I do. OK, I need a login. Oh, now I need a login service. Let me go build that. Right. So no pseudocode. I'm just kind of going through it. You know, you're not going to stop and say what's responsible for what. You're just going to put it wherever it is that you're at in the process. Right. And this is kind of how a code smell starts. You know what I mean? And how something like that can occur. So I like your approach because it kind of forces you to think about it a little bit. And then you can more easily ask those questions. Because like when I'm a new developer and I'm just trying to like get code out and I don't know what I'm doing, I certainly don't have a point where I'm thinking, how can this be written better? You know what I mean? As I'm going through it. And the pseudocode is a great behavior to kind of get you there.
Yeah, you're just kind of sitting in a corner and saying to yourself, please, God, let this work this time. And that's fine. We've all started there. We've all been there.
The worst is when it works first time. Then you're like really unsure of what's going on.
Here. Yeah, you're like, I messed something up so bad that I can't even see what went wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think when it comes to these services, I'm just going to sort of lay out some ideas here. Let's use this login example because I think it's at least a strong starting point. So let's say you have this login component. It's probably going to keep track of what's in the username box, what's in the password box, and it's got a submit button. And that's pretty much all it cares about right now. And then you have a service that is probably responsible for calling and hitting your login endpoints. Now, you could just in that service write in some logic using RxJS tap, right? You could tap into that and you could say, when this comes back, if it's successful, I want to do this. If it's not successful, I want to do that. And then your component has the ability to subscribe to that call and it doesn't need to know that all this background stuff about storing a cookie or storing current user. It doesn't need to know that any of that existed. It's not relevant to it, so it doesn't do it.
Yeah, and this is where people make the mistake of putting things in the component more than what they probably need to, right? Because the linear way, if you follow my example without pseudocoding, is you're going to call the login endpoint, you're going to subscribe to that, you're going to get the response, and then you're going to realize you need to save the token. So what you'll probably do is you'll take that response, you'll call another service endpoint, you know, to do the save, right? If, or you'll just save it in the component is another option. But like, if you take that step, you know, each time, and you don't think about the whole problem, you're not even going to consider like, oh wait, like, why don't I just do it all at once? You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's a question of responsibility as well. Like, which should be responsible for this? Is the component responsible? We've already talked about that. Probably not. Is the login service responsible for that? Well, probably in that case. But let's go switch our example up. Let's talk about something slightly different. Let's say that you have this concept in your application. You want to go from your customer list, and you want to go access a customer. And now you're going to go from the customer list page to a detail page for that customer. And whenever you do that, let's say that you also have this concept on the header or nav area, wherever, the most recent 5 customers you've accessed. In other words, you want to keep a listing of these last 5 customers that you've seen so that you can quickly jump between them. So this is like a concept that comes up sometimes in business logic. Now, the question I'm having here is, should the component be the one to call the most recent customers visited service? Yes or no?
No.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a case to be made in both directions, but I like your answer. It was very declarative. So, I mean, what we could do is we could say in the get details for customer, which is probably a call that we have in our details component, we need to get the details for this customer. When we make that call, we could say, whenever you do this, why don't you register that I just did this for this customer in the most recent, recently viewed customer service. And in that way, the component doesn't have to care that there's this extra business logic about remembering the last 5 customers.
Yeah, and especially like, think about, you're probably going to want to maybe show that recent customer list somewhere else, you know what I mean? And you don't want to have logic that's tied to that stuff in these customer components, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You want to be calling out so that, you know, if I want to, you know, say it's like a merged list of 2 different entities, you know what I mean? Like recent visits in general. Now, if you had it all in customers and then you also want users, how do you reconcile those 2 things? You know what I mean? So I think it's good to move that stuff out whenever you can.
Yeah, because there might be more than one way that I even view a customer, right? Like maybe there's a detail page, and maybe there's a summary page, and maybe there's a notes only page, but maybe all 3 I want to trigger that you most recently viewed this customer. You know, if you think about it from those terms, man, it sure would be nice to have a central location to be in charge of whether that occurs.
Yeah, and I'm actually surprised we made it this far without pointing out the fact that like one of those code smells can be like duplication of code, right? So like if you didn't have it in the service, you would be duplicating this code over and over again. And you know, one of the things that we did recently in one of our projects that I kind of liked is, you know, in a lot of our detail pages, we tend to have fork joins, and we use RxJS fork joins because, you know, sometimes these detail pages have dropdowns for like status, like customer status, customer source, whatever the case is. And you want to pull that information whenever you load, right? And sometimes you need to do that on like 7 pages. So you end up like, for the longest time, we would just fork join these 2 things, fork join these 2 things, fork join these 2 things over and over and over again before like it dawned on us like, hey, why don't we just create our own observable that fork joins these 2 things, and we just subscribe to that and say, you know, get dropdowns or whatever. That's probably, hopefully we didn't use that name, but you know, get all the dropdowns for this screen. And you know, it's more purposeful. It keeps things cleaner, nicer, easier to read. I don't have to go look at that service to figure out what's happening. I know it's giving me all the data for my dropdowns. And you stop doing code duplication there, which is really nice.
Yeah, I mean, you could even think of it as this kind of scenario. Like imagine that you had something that you wanted to call just get customer filter items, you know, all the items I would need for filtering with customers, because I would need that in the customers list. I would need that in the customer reports section. I might need it if I'm using auditing and I have like a customers auditing section and I want to filter that as well. So those may not be the same screens, They may not all feature exactly the same filters, but I probably want a similar set of items each time. And in order to facilitate that, it's exactly that scenario. You take a fork join, you throw it into a service, and you return it. And then you don't have to write the fork join separately in all those cases.
Yeah. And I think it's probably worth maybe discussing one more example that you and I did just very recently that I think was a great exercise in cleaning things up and making code a little bit nicer and easier to read. And you know what I want to do is so we use GitLab at Miles to do all our source control. And one of the things we've been working on more and more is leveraging the GitLab API to automate things or help us get information about our code and things that we're using. So up to this point, it has been a pet project for me. I need to do something with GitLab rather than doing it manually. I write some scripts to interact with the API. Like most pet projects, it's built up without a lot of forethought and thinking. And so you end up with this big, I think I had three different REST clients or wrappers that I was using to interact with the GitLab API because I did one and I didn't like it. Then I did another one. I didn't like that. I did another one. So I think our approach that we took for that was really awesome. And do you want to kind of walk through, because you came into it cold, where I think we're trying to set the stage for what this scenario is about. You're going into code that you haven't read or you don't remember. What was your first sort of interaction with that?
Yeah, I mean the first thing I looked at was I did a quick scan of the code, and I say scan because just like you were in your code smells introduction area, you don't go in depth. You don't try to understand every little piece of everything. You just sort of scan it over and take a look. And what I saw was that we were making raw HTTP requests. Here's the exact URL I want to hit for this scenario. And I said to myself, well, okay, this API, obviously, every API out there has some kind of documentation, right? And it says you call this way and you add these filters. And these are the parameters we expect to see, and here's the result set. And we didn't even have any typing on that at that point. So I was like, okay, so clearly one of the things we could do is we could pull this out into some sort of API, client manager factory or something like that, where the different calls we need to make to the API are pulled away. And we don't need to have our token, because I remember in the original stuff, we actually had our token coming from the environment file, write in the actual code doing the work versus, extract it away into some sort of how do we make API calls library. And that was the first thought that I had.
Yeah. And I think it's an important point to make that it's okay to write code that smells,
Oh, yeah.
In my scenario, I didn't even know that we would be using this for more than the specific use case that I was building at the time. Right. And what we're trying to, I think, get across here is this was the fourth or fifth time we were going to write a function, right? And we had a choice to make. Do we duplicate all of the previous code? Do we use a fourth REST client to communicate with the API? Or do we sit down for, I think it took me and you maybe an hour to really take what we had, restructure it, reorganize it, put things in better places, and verify that the code was still working. And we did that for about an hour, and then we spent the next 2 hours adding the new logic and functionality, and it was very pleasant. It was easy to do. It made sense. We both understood the code a little bit better, and I was much more happy with where we were headed and the result and what it could be.
Yeah, I feel like if we brought a third person into it, they would have a much easier time understanding what's going on. If I didn't have you there to explain to me what was happening when we first started, I don't know that I would have gotten it very fast. I probably would have made a bunch of questions on a document and sent it to you and said, John, I need your help. But now I think if a third person comes in, they're going to be able to follow it much quicker and easier because it is logically separated, if you will.
Yeah, awesome. All right. Well, I think we're coming up towards the end here. And maybe anything else you want to cover before we jump into final thoughts?
There is one last thing, and I will try to make it extremely brief.
Sure.
And that is, I wanted to talk about if you are making multiple chained subscription calls in your components, because you may think to yourself, maybe there's not an easier way to go here, or maybe how would I pull this out? And when I say multiple chained subscription calls, I'm talking about where you have to subscribe to some call to your backend or your API, and it comes back with a value, and I need that value in order to make the second call. I'll give you an example here. Let's say that you wanted to get the current user's manager. You don't know who the current user's manager is, but you get that call. It comes back with a manager ID, and you say, okay, now that I have the manager ID, let's go get that user's information. Well, I can see where you think to yourself, I have to do this as a chain subscription, so I should probably do that in the component. And that's true, except for RxJS does give us a way that we can put these calls together and use the value from the first call in the second call, and then eventually only have one subscription. So the component, to it looks like it made one call. But technically in the back, on the service side, it's actually doing two. And in this situation, what you would use is switch map. So you would take the first call, and instead of just returning it as an observable, you would use the property pipe. I was just trying to remember what the heck the name of the property is that you do to chain things together. So you do dot pipe off of that to modify the observable. You use switch map and you say the answer I got from that using the next call. And in that way, it makes things much more easy to read in the component. I don't have to read subscription inside a subscription. And believe me, I've seen it go three or four layers there. And then that gets really hard to read. So definitely it's easier to have the service do that work if possible.
Yeah, chaining can get really... crazy really quick.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think I think if you're interested in that sort of stuff, or you're unsure of what the heck Chris is talking about, like I tend to be sometimes when he talks about RxJS, I would stay tuned. I think we're planning on doing another RxJS episode coming up real soon. The last one was very popular. Seems like a lot of people enjoyed it, because I think it is the thing that people want to use most or more than what they are currently using. And that's a great example of a way you could do that with that manager and then dependent information on the manager. So that's awesome.
Yeah.
Cool. So final thoughts on writing some clean components and well-organized components.
You going to go first, John?
Yeah, I could go first.
All right.
So I think that there's like a very heavy or a very long line of things that you can do. You know, and you can be very far on one end or very far on the other end. And I want to encourage people that, you know, you don't have to know great design patterns. You don't have to know abstraction, generics, all this stuff, which, you know, people tend to associate with, you know, clean or organized code, typically. You know, a great example is like what we just talked about. You know, we wrote some code. It was, you know, kind of built up. It was grassroots. It didn't have a lot of understanding or purpose behind it. And we decided, hey, this is the time. We're going to rewrite it. We're going to make it better. And we don't have to do anything crazy. You know, we just have to look at it real quick, get a second opinion, right? This process should not be done in isolation for sure. You know, especially until you get real comfortable with doing it a bunch of times. You know, get another person's opinion, walk through, do the rubber ducky sort of thing where you just explain it to somebody and see if it makes sense. And you can make a lot of really minor changes and minor improvements. And that's what ends up, you know, having clean code. You know, if you think about it, like I live in a house. I don't, you know, clean my whole house once every week, right? Like that's not how things work. You're not just going to take your whole code base and clean it up one day. I clean the bathrooms one day, I vacuum another day, I sweep another day. Like you have to build these things up. You can't just, you know, all of a sudden have clean code and clean architecture. So think of it as a rolling sort of process.
But the question is, do you get all of that cleaning still done in 1 week? Yes or no?
No.
I didn't think so.
Yeah, you gotta keep going on it, but you need to have, like, I need to say to myself, hey, I need to do this cleaning right on a regular basis. Otherwise, you know, before you turn around and you look, you've forgot about something for so long, it's quite a mess. So, and I think we all agree it's easier to clean things that aren't, you know, that you haven't left to become super dirty. You know, like, one of the things I haven't cleaned in a very long time is my garage, because it's so messed up at this point that I don't even want to get started on it.
Yeah, I can see
you?
That.
What do you think about this whole clean, organized component thing?
I'm a huge fan of pulling things out to the right layer, making small services that are purposeful. Even having services consume other services. Like, for instance, you could have your CRUD service, and rather than muddying that up with a bunch of logic of remembering to store recent visits to something, you could have a recent visit service that consumes the one and takes care of the other. You know, have your services be small, purposeful, even have them chained together if necessary. Same thing with components. And I just think that that's a good way to try to go about it. It's not going to work in all cases, but I think it's a good thing to strive for. The only other thing I have as a final thought, we haven't talked a whole lot in any of our podcasts yet having to do with the workflow of development. For instance, merge requests, we've mentioned them, but we haven't really talked much about merging or issues or how do you close them out. I'll say this. I think a lot of people out there, at least in my experience, look at merge requests as give me permission to put my code into this code base. Give me permission for this set of changes to be accepted. And in fact, even the wording in a lot of merge requests kind of supports this. It's accept or reject. And I really want to have people take a step back and think of merge requests differently. Think of it this way. If I send this code to you in a merge request, what do I actually want? Do I want you to accept it and put it into the pipeline? Or maybe what I want is I want your feedback. I want you to tell me what you don't like about it or what you think could be done better or what did you find confusing? See, it's about perspective is what I'm trying to say. If I write code, it makes sense to me, but it may not make sense to the next guy because I have my perspective and they have theirs. So this merge request should be something where you're looking for feedback and you want to have someone tell you that they need to have something updated to make it more clear to them, or they would think that this is the old way of doing it and we should move to the new way, even though it's not consistent with the current code base. Now's the time. Let's start refactoring. You want that kind of feedback.
Yeah, I mean, you shouldn't be, like I said, everybody writes smelly code. You should encourage people to call it out, you know, because you want to fix it as much as they do.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's just an awareness thing. So,
yep.
Awesome. Great. Well, thanks everybody for listening to another podcast on all things Angular. And this one actually got into a little other realm of software development, which is nice. So hopefully you enjoyed it. If you want to give us more suggestions or talk about how you clean up architecture, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach out to us on Twitter. I'm at John Graham Dev, G-R-A-H-A-M Dev, and Chris is at Pilgrim Secret. That's the best way to get in contact with us and let us know what you think. We'd love to hear from you. One other thing to announce is we do actually have a website now. So you can go to ngbuildpod.com and check out our website. It just kind of shows information about all of our latest releases and things like that, a little bit about Chris and I if you're curious about that. And then you can always check out our blogs. Chris is on Medium and I'm at johngraham.dev for my blog. So thanks a lot for listening, everybody. Chris, what else do we have to promote?
Well, I just want to make sure and mention to everyone that if you're looking for a career in development, or even if you just like the way that our template sounds and you want to be a part of that, you can always go to www.milestechnologies.com/careers. We are always looking for good talent.
Awesome. Yeah, great. Okay, that's it. Thanks, everybody.
Yeah, thanks so much.
See ya.